Hey, everybody. This is Don McCauley. I'm the president and founder of Law Preview. And I welcome you guys to the second in our spring webinar series. Now that you've been accepted to law school, how are you going to pay for it? It seems that this is a pretty timely and important topic because we've got so many people online. This is actually the largest number of attendees that we've had on any of one of our webinars. So let's just dive right into it. We have a great panel for you guys tonight. We have Stephen Brown, who's the Dean of Admissions and Financial Aid at Fordham Law School. We have Pat Scroll, Dean of Admissions at University of Maryland School of Law. And we have Lindsay Stetson, the Dean of Financial Aid at University of Michigan. Hi, guys. Can everybody hear me? I guess so. Yes. I'll take that as a yes. All right. So we could just jump right into the questions. And you know, as I imagine that most folks are probably starting to get their acceptance letters. When I was in law school or applying to law school, you get a fat envelope. But I guess now, what do you guys send out, an email? You just tweet to them? Dean Brown, is that how it works?
No, an email and then a fat envelope.
Okay, good.
Well, the fat envelope. Still send the big envelope.
Good. Well, some things haven't changed. Well, again, thank you guys so much for for agreeing to spend an hour with us and talking about something that might be second nature to you guys, but for our attendees and even for me, paying for law school is almost as important, probably just as important a decision as to go to law school itself. So let me just, lead off with the first question. Generally, what are, for students who aren't really thinking about the price tag of what that fat envelope means, really, like, on average, like, how expensive is law school? And I'll open it up to you guys. You guys can, shout it out as you want.
Well, it ranges anywhere from about $18,000 a year without financial aid at some of the public law schools, clear up to $60,000 a year. Right. So it's really an investment, and one of the things we hope to convey throughout this hour or so is this idea of law school as an investment.
And I would add that, one thing that's important for students to think about is, those numbers that Stephen mentioned, that is a range of tuition costs. But students should also think about how much does it cost to live in the city where the school is located. What sort of housing costs, food costs, transportation costs, books are you looking at that can add a significant amount of money, between $15,000 and $25,000 or $30,000 per year to your cost of attending law school. So it's important to look not just at the tuition number, but at the total cost of what that investment really means for you on an annual basis.
Well, since we've got some geographic diversity, between the three schools, Fordham, Michigan, and Maryland, I mean, what's the average price tag, for a student, attending full-time as a full-time three-year JD student, let's say in New York, Michigan, and in Maryland? What do you guys budget for?
So in New York, our tuition is $52,000, and then we allow up to $22,000 for 9 months' worth of living expenses.
Gotcha. So you're looking at
Michigan?
$75,000 a year for New York?
Yes.
Okay. So at Michigan, our tuition is about $56,000 a year. And our living expenses, a student can borrow up to $18,500 a year. It's about $73,000 for a full cost of attendance.
Gotcha.
And at the University of Maryland, we are a state institution, so we have two brackets of tuition. For in-state students, it's $28,000, and for out-of-state students, it's $41,000 a year. And our cost of living ranges between $15,000 to $17,000 per year, for a total cost of attendance between $65,000 to $75,000, depending on where you fall in terms of in-state or out-of-state.
Kat, do some of the can people qualify for in-state residency after being there for a year?
Yes, if they meet all of the requirements in terms of residency, they may apply after the first year to the Office of Registrar at the general university level and qualify. So they're not precluded from qualifying for in-state tuition. Not all state schools do that, so certainly I encourage students to do their research if that is part of the plan and make sure that that is something that they can do. Some states do preclude changing in-state status after they enroll in the program.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so at Michigan, you have to have been a resident prior to enrolling. You cannot establish residency once you become a student. For better or for worse, though, the difference between our in-state and out-of-state tuition is only $3,000 per year.
Okay.
Gotcha. One of the interesting things is...
Stephen, we just lost you. I think your mic might be acting up. There. That's the teaser. You throw out one of the interesting things is, and then you know your mic cuts out.
Okay, I think I'm back.
Gotcha.
It's weird. I'm just sitting here. So one of the interesting things is we just touched on the concept of cost of attendance without talking about it. So cost of attendance is something set by each of the law schools. And it includes, as we were saying, tuition fees, books and supplies, room and board, personal expenses, perhaps a one-time documented cost of a computer. And this is something that students can use to compare law schools. And some schools have artificially low cost of attendance, saying it's cheaper to come to our law school. The sticker price is lower, and others, and we have that in New York, and we have other schools who are probably a tad high, saying, yes, you'll borrow more, but we want you to have a good experience while you're in law school.
Right. And, I mean, we're going to hit on scholarships and grants later in our questions. But, you know, on average, you mentioned sticker price. How many students or what percentage of your students actually pay full sticker price?
For us, it's about half.
About half?
For us, it's closer to about 30%.
Okay.
For Maryland, also close to 30%.
Okay, great. Well, yeah, now I think we've got everybody's attention. We were throwing around some pretty big numbers there. So what sources of funding available for students? And then, you know, how do you access them? You know, is there a process that you have to go through?
So the three main sources of funding at most schools are going to be merit-based scholarships, need-based grants, and loans. Schools will vary widely on their process for merit-based scholarships versus need-based grants and the amount which they allot to each of those categories, and I imagine the three of us could talk about our individual processes. And then many students, you know, at our institution, somewhere between 70 and 80% in a given year, take out loans to finance all or some portion of their education. The overwhelming majority of those students who are taking loans are borrowing federal student loans, with the exception of those students who would not be eligible for federal student loans because of their visa status.
Gotcha. So everybody's entitled to federal loans, right, in grad school?
Well, close to everybody. So you have to be a U.S. citizen or a permanent resident. Mm-hmm. Or a refugee in certain categories. You have to complete the FAFSA, the free application for federal student aid. Remember, it's the free application. If you're male, you have to be registered for the draft. You have to have a valid Social Security number and cannot be in default on other federal debt, prior student loan debt or other debt.
Is there a maximum you can borrow for federal student loans?
Oh, it's frightening. The standard direct loans, and we can talk some more about this, is $20,500 a year. But the Grad Plus loans, provided you have an absence of bad credit, you can borrow up to the full cost of attendance, less other aid, as determined by the institution. So the institution will look at what it costs you to live as a student for the year, come up with this cost of attendance, and then you could actually borrow at some schools as much as $80,000 a year on your signature.
Wow.
Without an ability to show that you can pay the loans back. And that's a little scary.
And then some schools also offer the federal Perkin loan, where students can get a maximum annual loan of $8,000. And that's for students who qualify with really high financial need.
So the Perkins is based on financial need, and the is it the direct or the Grad Plus loan? Are they two different products, or are they the same thing?
Yeah, that would be a third group.
Okay.
So it goes unsubsidized federal direct staffer loan, which is the first one mentioned in terms of you can borrow up to a total of $20,500 each year. Then you have the Graduate Plus loans for law students, and that one is the one that he mentioned in terms of up to cost of attendance, and the third grouping would be the federal Perkins loan. And that one is a maximum annual loan up to $8,000. And that is only available at some schools and only for students with high financial need.
Gotcha. And are all those I'm sorry, Lindsay. I didn't mean to cut you off.
I just wanted to piggyback on something that Stephen said, how easy it is with just your signature to take the loans. Federal loans, I think, are both a blessing and a curse for graduate students. It is very, very easy to borrow significant sums of money each year, and so students can find themselves taking a very large amount of debt without having to put much thought into having done so. At the same time, the ease of getting loans means that funding is available for anyone who wants to go to law school, with the exceptions that Stephen mentioned. So I think it's really important for students to take the time to think about what it is that they're doing when they borrow that money, because it is so easy to do. It is incumbent upon the students themselves to talk to financial aid officers, to attend webinars like this, to really think about what does this debt mean.
Right. And about the investment. Is the school going to get you what you want in terms of the academics, the life, the degree, but also the jobs? It's becoming more and more important. I'm not an old guy, but when I started, the most you could borrow for law school was $24,000 for all 3 years combined.
Right.
And that world has changed, and we see students with $200,000 in debt, or students coming to us with $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 in undergraduate debt. That's why the three of us are here tonight talking about this, to keep.
I also think it's important to note that the interest rates are different for different federal loans, and more importantly, they start accruing while you're in law school. So I can't stress enough what my colleagues stress in terms of paying attention to what you're accumulating. I know that I believe at all three of our schools we have excellent financial aid in terms of making sure somebody is there to counsel you through the process and really understanding what it means, not only in the admissions process, but also while you're a student. Kind of check in with somebody at the school that is able to counsel you through it so that you have all of the information that you need on a year-by-year basis. We always encourage students to basically think of cost of attendance on a yearly basis, because you may be able to adjust after first year and lower the amount that you're borrowing for second year or even third year, depending on what your expenses are. I think students have a tendency to kind of keep the same amount all 3 years. You may find ways to cut on your expenses. So those are ways in which you can manage your debt a little bit better throughout the time that you're in law school.
Right.
Okay, so I'll bring us back. So the primary source for many students for financing law school are loans. There are federal loans. So the direct loan, $20,500 a year. Again, you have to complete a FAFSA, meet the citizenship and Social Security and draft test. That interest is accruing right now at, what is it, 4.38? I should know this off the top of my head, and I don't.
6.8% for unsubsidized federal direct staffer loans and 7.9% for the graduate plus loans.
I'm sorry. Just to, if we're stepping all the way back, can we just clarify for some of the attendees, they may not know the difference between subsidized versus unsubsidized loans and what that means?
Sure. At the graduate level, graduate professional level, unfortunately, there are no federal subsidized loans. Congress in 2014 decided that graduate and professional students were not in need of the subsidy. The money was needed to increase Pell Grants, so the subsidy had gone away. The undergraduate level, some of the direct loans are subsidized. Interest does not accrue while you're in school. At the graduate and professional level, all of the federal loans, two of the federal loans, the direct loans and the Grad Plus, interest is accruing while you're in school.
Gotcha. Okay.
The Perkins loan is subsidized. Perkins loan, again, not all schools have that, but the interest is not accruing on that loan.
Okay. Got it. And then you have private loans, right, to make up any balance or any shortfall between what the federal government's going to loan you and what you really need to live.
Well, that's where it gets dicey. If you have good credit or if you have an absence of bad credit, you can borrow Grad Plus. And you can borrow that up to cost of attendance less other aid. So the private loans come in for different reasons. Sometimes we'll see students who, what is an absence of bad credit for federal loans? It's current accounts 90 days past due if the amount now exceeds $2,085. Or any charge-offs, write-offs, bankruptcies, foreclosures in the past 5 years. So we do occasionally run into students who were turned down for the Grad Plus loans but have a high enough credit score that they might be able to borrow private loans. Private loans, kind of imagine walking into a bank and saying, hi, I need a loan. And the bank says, well, yeah, what kind of collateral do you have? Collateral?
Oh, my brain.
Savings, stocks, bonds, real estate, cars. No, I have a brain, but I won't be working for 3 years or perhaps 4 years going part-time. So many of the private lenders, the loan is risky. It's not guaranteed. It's not insured by the federal government. So many of the private lenders are looking for people with a good credit history and possibly employment, or looking for someone to borrow with a cosigner, someone who's willing to take on the full risk of that loan along with the student.
Gotcha. Do you know what the interest rates right now range for on the private loans?
Private loan interest rates are a little lower because they follow the market rate. So some of the loans are at prime plus 1% or LIBOR plus 3%. So, they could be as low as 3, 4, or 5% right now, but realize that we are in a very, very low interest environment, and these loans get to be paid back over 10 or 15 or 20 years, and I can guarantee you at some point in that time, interest rates are going up. If I knew exactly, I wouldn't be on this webinar, I'd be on another one and making lots of money.
So the private loans will fluctuate then? In terms of the interest rate?
So their interest rates are variable. Some are adjusted monthly, some quarterly, some annually.
Gotcha. And the federal loan is set for the period?
It's set for the life of the loan that you borrow. So any loan you borrow this year is fixed at this interest rate for the life of the loan. When you borrow next year, you'll have a different interest rate on that loan, which will be fixed for the life of that loan.
Gotcha. Okay. Wow. Now I'm starting to break out into a cold sweat. I guess one thing that, that becomes patently clear from this is if you have problems with your credit, now is the time to be cleaning it up. At least working to clean it up. You probably should have cleaned it up last year. Brings us to the step. So what are the process that, when should students begin the financing process? Should they wait until they get that fat envelope? Or should they be, in the process of doing it now?
So You know, the first step, I think, for any student is to obtain a copy of their credit report. Mm-hmm. A lot of young people have not done that before, and they may be surprised by what's on there. Could be, you know, an electric bill that you signed up for with your roommate in undergrad, and everybody skipped out on it. I know in my day it was signing up for Columbia House CD subscriptions, and people would
pay
those.
Wow, Lindsay, you are dating yourself there. Not only with the Columbia House reference, which I love, I think I still have a Grandmaster Flash album that I'm trying to get rid of, but then even the CD, kids are like, what? What's a CD? Like, go ahead.
I know, most listeners don't know what I'm talking about. But the fact is, many people are surprised to find what's on there. So you can get a free copy of your credit report every year. Now is a good time to take a look at it. The next step is to fill out the FAFSA, as Stephen mentioned, the free application for federal student aid. And that can really be done at any point. Certainly, in the time of year where we are right now, it's a good idea to fill it out if you haven't already. It's typically better to have completed your previous year's tax return if you'll be filing a tax return, although that won't be an issue after this year. But to have already completed your taxes because you need that information for the FAFSA. And then once you've gotten that big fat envelope from the school, that's when you can start exploring each school's merit-based scholarship and need-based grant process.
Gotcha. Okay. Kat, you want to add anything?
No, basically that's the same. I think one of the caveats that students tend to forget that is when you are applying for aid at the graduate level or professional school level, you are being considered financially independent of your parents. So for that purpose, you just need to be aware that that is the information that is required to be as part of the federal aid applications, and that your parents' information is not necessarily required. Some schools may ask for it, but it's not required. So you really need to pay attention for the first time to what that means to be financially independent in terms of filing taxes. Some of our students, is basically the first time that they're ever filing taxes. So ideally, you want to start the process sometimes before you get the envelope from the school. Certainly, you want to start before, if you're planning ahead and you're looking now at fall 2017, you really want to plan to have everything lined up late December, early January. So by the time the January deadline comes about for the FAFSA, you have everything ready to go.
Gotcha. Does the Grad Plus loan work off the FAFSA as well, or is that a separate application?
So the loan applications are a separate process. The FAFSA determines your eligibility for the loan. They do the citizenship check and the default check and the name check and Social Security. And then online a day later you get an email and it says, you are eligible for federal aid. Yay. This next step from there, once you've decided which school you're going to attend, is to actually apply for the loans. And that process can be an online process. Some schools will have you fill out their form online. You'll have to sign a master promissory note that will – it's kind of an open-ended promissory note. Again, a little scary, but you'll do it once in your career. You'll also have to take a federal entrance interview online. It's a video and quiz. It should take about 15 or 20 minutes. And at that point, then you're eligible for the loans.
Gotcha.
Every school is going to be a little different. So once you've decided where you're going to attend, then it's important to be in touch with the school.
And find out the process. And just there was a question from one listener about the existence of federal student loans from undergrad. That doesn't prohibit them at all from, you know, accessing the direct or the Grad Plus loans, correct?
Like many things, financial aid, mostly correct. There's a cap in total borrowing of $138,500 in the direct loans. So if a student had a prior graduate degree, generally, or professional degree, they may run up against that cap, although it's very unusual.
Okay. So you'd have to go to med school or business school or something like that beforehand.
Or another master's degree.
Gotcha.
And again, that's only on the direct loans. The Grad Plus is still something of a profit center for the government. Oh, I'll get in trouble for that. but it is. And as long as you have this absence of bad credit, they'll continue to lend to you.
Okay. Well, once Trump gets into office, he'll just abolish it anyway. So we'll have that. You won't have to worry about the Grad Plus loans anymore, I'm sure. Okay, let me just hop to the next set of questions here. We discussed how a student's credit score is going to affect their financing options. So, one question I'd love for you guys to sort of weigh in on is, how much, if your kid was going to law school starting in the fall, what would you advise them on the amount that they should borrow?
So I think a good first step for any student is to make a budget. Set aside for a moment the cost of attendance that the school has created for you, because that's an easy default. It's easy to just enter their number into the box, into the Grad Plus loan application, and say, I'll borrow that much. So make a budget for yourself. Think about, in this area, with my living requirements, how much can I live on? How much do I really need? And I think you'll hear any financial aid person who works with law students say, live like a law student now so you can live like a lawyer later. Now is not the time to take fancy trips or do a lot of shopping. That's the living expense part. As far as tuition is concerned, that is a set cost. Students have some flexibility there if they're able to get scholarships. There are outside sources of scholarships, non-institutional scholarships available. If it were my child going to law school, I would encourage them to apply for as many of those as possible, even if they're $500 or $1,000, because every bit is reducing the amount that you have to borrow, the amount that's accruing interest over 3 years, the amount that you have to pay back. But as Stephen has said a couple times, you also have to consider that this is an investment. And so it's not always about borrowing the least possible amount. It's borrowing an amount that makes sense, given what you think you can get from an institution and what your career goals are and what is realistic for you to be able to pay back, given those career goals.
Right.
I also think it's important to consider another factor that can be used in budgeting is asking the school that you plan to attend, or even when you're still considering a couple of the schools, what is the average law school graduate debt from that particular school? That gives you at least some kind of margin in terms of whether you are too high when budgeting for that particular school or too low in terms of what other students have done in the past to that particular school. And that actually gives you a better number in terms of when you graduate, how much will you have in debt from that particular school, and you can even do a quick calculator using the financial aid calculators on how much would a monthly payment after look like and so on. So you really have a more realistic idea of what is that debt going to look like after.
Do you guys have a favorite website that you guys send students to figure out that, or that has the calculator?
We actually have it on our website. I can tell you what the website is. But,
Shameless plug, Kat. I love it.
Go ahead. I know.
Yeah, as do we. We have it on our website because we want students to know what they're getting themselves into over the course of the 3 years. We touched on free money a little bit. Before we do free money, just a comment and a thought on repayment. The standard repayment on the federal loans has been 10 years, and it has been 10 years since 1972 when the first loans came out. Reality is, as students are borrowing more at the graduate or undergraduate level, there are many income-driven repayment plans being offered by the federal government for the federal loans. This is one of the advantages of federal loans. They may be eligible for the income contingent plans as opposed to some of the private loans. So the income contingent plans are amazing, kind of the greatest thing since chocolate cake, but scary at the same time, because there's a real movement in the country in the last 7 or 8 years for, on the federal loan side, to repayment no longer being a 10-year experience, but really being a 20-year experience.
Oh, wow. So, and that would be based off of the income that you're making when you graduate from law school?
Every year.
Okay. Oh, so every year
graduation, every year after graduation. You have to renew every year. It's amazing. First year for the new pay program was 2 years ago, and only 52% of borrowers renewed. So many of them wound up going delinquent and some even into default. Because they didn't fill out the paperwork. Lawyers know better, of course.
Right, right. Yeah, you would hope so. Probably not always the case, I'm sure. Also, talking about repayment, there was a question from one of the listeners about if you have current undergraduate student loans, are you able to defer those loan payments during law school? And what's your advice on that, if you are?
So if you have federal undergraduate student loans, mm-hmm. those can be deferred during law school. If they are unsubsidized, you will continue to accrue interest on those loans while you are a student. If you have private loans, the answer is it depends. Most private loans have a limited amount of time in which you can have a deferment. So if you've already used that time period up, it's possible you might have to continue to make payments while you are in law school.
Gotcha. All right. Oh, okay. So let's talk briefly about merit, need-based, conditional, and then you touched on it, Leslie, the outside scholarships. One of the things when I founded Law Preview, I also founded a website called admissionsdean.com that has a scholarship finder, which we populated with, I think there's 400 plus outside scholarships for students who are going to law school or graduate school. And I was shocked. I mean, when I went to law school, I never looked at outside scholarships, but they're, some are as low as, a couple $100, some are as high as 10,000. But if you're your great grandfather was a stevedore in, New Jersey, you might be eligible for a scholarship, which you wouldn't have to repay, which is pretty cool. I was kind of shocked about how much money there is actually out there, for folks who are willing to jump through the hoops. But just can you give me a good idea? And I know it's not going to be universal for every law school, but in terms of merit and need-based scholarships, what are you guys looking for, when you're granting, that kind of aid to a student?
So let's break it up. Let's talk about merit, and then we'll talk about need.
Okay.
Although there are some schools who have it together. And you'll get three different answers from us.
Okay.
On the merit side, kind of many schools are looking to GPA and LSAT. There's this magazine you may have heard of. They rank law schools. Apparently they're coming out next week. And GPAs and LSATs matter. Other schools have merit money or kind of other money looking at diversity. We have a big geographic diversity scholarship. Others are looking to racial and ethnic diversity. Interest in different courses of study, interest in different activities in law school. But one of the things to understand is merit may be different at different schools. Just like students at certain GPA and LSAT ranges they are admitted to some schools, denied from others, are at the top of an admitted pool in some, bottom of others, it's similar with merit scholarship. Just because a school gave you $20,000 doesn't mean all schools will give you $20,000.
Right. So, I mean, obviously there are some schools out there that are looking to buy your score, right, to improve their rankings in whatever publication is ranking schools these days, because LSAT and I guess does undergraduate GPA also factors into that as well. in terms of merit scholarships, I mean, at your institutions, you know, is that a big form of aid for students?
So for Michigan, the answer is yes. Of the institutional aid that we offer, about 80 to 90% is offered through our merit aid process, and only about 10 to 20% each year is offered through need-based grants. We just have one form of merit scholarship. So we're looking largely at LSAT and GPA, but we're also taking a look at, you know, an applicant's whole application. So, you know, different kinds of work experience or background can come into play. At Michigan, we can't take racial or ethnic diversity into account. So it is a race and ethnicity blind process. So we're just looking at the information we have in your application.
Gotcha.
And at Maryland, everyone is considered for merit-based awards, just like my colleagues mentioned. What I'll say is different. We are a state institution, so the merit-based aid from the school, we have the law school level, the university level, and the state level. And I always encourage students to, if you're considering state schools, they may have different types of merit-based source that is not only linked to the law school. There may be more. So for us, all of our students are considered in terms of merit-based, and we consider certainly academic credentials, but professional experience does play a factor, or how involved they were in school, leadership potential, and so on, is all part of kind of what our review process is when we're considering scholarships. In terms of, we do have, like some law schools do, application-specific scholarship. Basically, you have to apply for the scholarships, and the reason for that is that those scholarships have specific requirements. So I know we have a group of scholarships that is only for folks that have had at least 3 years of experience, work experience, ideally closer to between 5 and 7 years of work experience, and the idea is to give it to somebody that would have gone part-time, but it's a full scholarship, full tuition scholarship for somebody who now can go full-time instead of part-time. And then we have other scholarships that are based on leadership ability, and those are application-specific only. And I know certainly there are plenty of law schools out there that have different constrictions. For those, you do have to be very mindful of deadlines. Some of the deadlines are very early in the process. In terms of, I would say the majority of my colleagues that have those specific ones tend to be between December to January, February deadlines for especially the ones that required some kind of application process. What I'll say about the university level, in our case, for example, and I know some of the other state schools have something like this too, we do have university level application scholarships. Students have to apply for those as well, and they don't come through the law school funding, they actually come through the university level. And lastly, if you are going to a state school, the state itself may have scholarships to attract students from out of state to come to the state, or to encourage students who are in state to stay in the state, and they have different brackets of scholarships. At Maryland, there are several scholarships available at the state level for students who are attending law school or other graduate programs.
Wow. Thanks for that. That was very thorough. In terms of need based, what exactly are you guys looking there? I'm assuming it's financial need, but you know, anybody walking out of undergrad with, you know, $100,000 in student loans is going to at least claim, you know, some financial hardship. So what do you guys actually look for?
So again, schools will look differently. 7 years ago, almost all our aid was need-based. We didn't have merit aid. We were competing with different types of schools. The merit aid, the ABA will tell you, has exploded in the last 5 to 7 years. At some level, it's something of a buyer's market for students, but they still have to be careful and use judgment. On the need-based side, which is a little more than 20% of our aid, you are absolutely correct. Our students look the same, basically poor. So we do something, and many other law schools who have need-based aid may look to family. may look to students' spouses, may look to parents. And it's not like parents at the undergraduate level where the subsidies depend on the parents, or where students can't borrow to replace parental contributions. Students certainly can, but it gives us the sense of family financial strength. Is somebody coming from a family earning $400,000 or $500,000 a year is probably, and who graduated college and is working for $30,000 a year, is different than somebody who comes from a family where parents may be earning $50,000 or $60,000. And yet the recent college grad is working, earning $30,000 a year. So it's a challenge. And we talk to students about some of the realities. I've told my children graduate schools on their own will help at the undergraduate level. So I absolutely can sympathize with the students, or perhaps my kids can sympathize even more with their students who are saying, but no, I don't have access to family money, but it's something that the schools are kind of rationing a reasonably small amount of money and have to make decisions that way. So some schools will collect the parents' information on their own form. Some will use different private services are out there. You kind of have to pay to prove that you're poor. But again, that's something to pay attention to at the schools the students are interested in and make sure you meet the deadlines, make sure you fill out the application if that's what has to happen.
Gotcha. In terms of, I'm assuming that all of our listeners are going to law school because they want to be lawyers, and lawyers negotiate. I mean, how much of this is can you negotiate in terms of merit and need base? I'm sure that you get phone calls all the time saying, I want more. Is that something that happens? And I'm not putting you on the spot, for Fordham or Maryland or Michigan. But is that something that happens out there where you can negotiate, especially with a merit scholarship?
So I think that we would probably all say it certainly happens that students try, mm-hmm. And they try with varying levels of success. I think that most schools' stance is that they don't negotiate scholarships, that this is the award that we have made to you. Be it merit or need-based, and that is what we are offering you. That being said, it is a conversation where it is important for both the school and the student that the student is making the best possible choice. So we say, we don't negotiate, but we encourage you to talk with us about your decision, about, what other schools you're considering, what other financial aid offers you're considering, how cost of attendance plays a role there. There may be infrequent situations where we make an adjustment to someone's financial aid package, either because a peer school has made a very significantly different financial aid award where it just wouldn't even make sense for the student to choose our school.
Right.
Or if there were extenuating circumstances, particularly in the need-based realm, of which we were not aware when we made our original decision. And a lot of it also is, the student has to think about the way in which they are approaching this. There are different ways to approach a school to have a discussion about your aid package. There are polite and professional ways to do so, and there are impolite and unprofessional ways to do so, and I imagine the three of us have seen many examples of both.
Wait a minute, Lindsay. Now you're just begging me to ask the horror story in this. now I want to know. Are they driving by your house? Are they stalking you?
We'll save that for your horror story. And so I think, we want to develop a relationship with students because, again, you're making an investment in your education. We hope that if you come to any of our schools that you do so feeling like you have made an informed decision, and that the administrators in admissions and financial aid and in student services and career planning will be there to counsel you through the entire spectrum of your law school and legal career process. And so that can start at the admissions or financial aid stage. Most of the time, you probably won't see a change in your financial aid award, but these conversations are very important in making an informed decision.
Right. And
one of my favorites, Lindsay, and this goes back to Catherine's time, but a student I wrote, to whom it may concern. Now, all our names are all over the websites and things, but to whom it may concern. I've been admitted to you in Michigan. Michigan is a much higher ranked school. If you don't give me $10,000 more, I'm going to Michigan. So my response, dear Michigan student, sometimes it gets cold there. Use some of the money for a coat. And sent that, blind copied the former director of financial aid, who was a friend and colleague. But students should be careful. So this is the season that we are listening to appeals. Hey, students, while you're out there, read your award letter. I had a student yesterday, it was great, effectively argued for us to reduce his award dramatically. So I wrote back and said, thank you for pointing out these inconsistencies. We're reducing your award.
That's not what I meant.
Our award says it's X dollars a year guaranteed for each of your 3 years. Some other schools come out and say you're getting a total award of $90,000, and somewhere later in the letter it says divided over 3 years.
Right.
Our award letter went out and said you're getting $30,000. So he wrote and said, you're the greatest school, and the curriculum is right, and the faculty and everything is wonderful, but you're not giving me enough money. All these other schools are giving me $90,000, and you're just giving me $30,000.
Yeah, but Stephen, everybody goes to law school because they're bad at math. So, I mean, how can you expect your applicants to do that simple division?
Attention to detail.
What's that?
We do expect careful reading from our law students.
That's true. Do you guys ever, will you fact check somebody who says, hey, look, I'm getting, X dollars from Michigan? Will you, ping Michigan and say, is this true? Or do you take them at face value?
We ask for a copy of their letter from another school.
Gotcha. Okay. Gotcha. Now,
it is rare, but there have been cases where students have inflated their awards from other schools, and upon request of that letter, we have discovered such an inflation.
And then, first of all, I'm a big believer in, any time you're starting out a relationship like law school or you're building your professional relationship right from the very beginning. And the last thing you want to do is show up on campus and having been that troublemaker student. But, if somebody's lying to you, in that process, in the financial aid process, does that ultimately affect their, admission status as well? Or could it?
What admission status? They are no longer admitted.
Oh, great. Good to know. I'm sure that
we take that seriously, and we tell students it's on the application. It's a character and fitness issue. If you're going to lie to get into law school or to get money from us or something like that, you're going to have to go somewhere else, because if we catch you, you're gone. We'll give you due process. We detail that out, but that's a really, really, really bad way to start a career where ethics is a very high value and public trust is a very high value.
Right.
And we've done that to people.
Oh, and
they've done it to themselves.
Yeah, the last thing the profession needs is another, somebody who's going to lie to get ahead. So we've talked about need-based, merit-based, and outside scholarships. One other scholarship that seems to be coming increasingly popular is the conditional scholarship. And if you could, I don't know if you guys even offer a conditional scholarship, but if you could just describe to students who are listening right now about some schools that are and the risks, that come with a conditional scholarship.
So we don't offer conditional scholarships. Ours are considered unconditional, but the concept of a conditional scholarship is you have been awarded $10,000 per year for all 3 years, provided that you maintain for example, a 3.2 GPA, or that you remain in the top 50% of the class. The assumption being that not everyone who receives a merit scholarship will be able to obtain such a GPA because law school classes are graded on a curve, or that a certain number of people will fall outside the top, you know, whatever group you've chosen, top half, top three quarters, whatever it may be. So if there is a GPA requirement in your scholarship letter, it's very important to ask the school, you know, where does that fall? What percentage of students achieve that GPA? Of course, if it's a percentage on the face of the letter, then you know 50% of the students or 75% of the students can retain their scholarship and the rest do not. Now, at Michigan, we say you have to remain in good standing, which basically means academically eligible to return to the school. That's not considered a conditional scholarship because, in that case, you have bigger problems than financial aid.
Right.
But to the extent that there's any sort of GPA above the minimum to be academically eligible to return to the school, or some sort of ranking requirement, that's really something to be aware of because you may end up without any aid after your first year of law school.
Yeah, that's really good advice. It surprises me how when you say a score like a 3.2 or sometimes you see a 3.4, a lot of students will say, oh, in undergrad, you know, I got into law school because I'm smart. I'll definitely get a 3.4. But when they actually ask the registrar or the dean of financial aid where that falls in the in ranking of the class, at a lot of schools that have the very strict grading curve, you know, a 3.4 might be, you know, in the top 20%, top 15% of the class.
Exactly. GPAs vary widely among schools. A 3.8 can be equivalent to a 3.4 or a 3.2 at another school when you're looking at, you know, where that lands in the class. All schools are required to report to the ABA whether they offer conditional or unconditional scholarships. So if it's not clear to the student from their aid letter, if the school is not giving clear information, the school's policy should be publicly available.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, it gets us to our last question, which will probably take the next 10 minutes. Maximizing your return on your investment in illegal education, and that's how I encourage students to think about law school is as an investment in themselves. And it also probably depends on what your goals are. I mean, if you're going into law school to go and save the world and want to do public interest, which is great. I think we need more people out there, definitely these days, especially saving the world. Or if your goal is to go and work at a large law firm, what's the best way to maximize your ROI on your legal investment?
So, know what you're getting into. Think about this. Think long-term goals. Which school will best get me there? What will this investment cost? What am I willing to put forward or to spend, literally to spend to look at what rate of return. And along with the information on the scholarships, schools are required by the ABA to have prominently displayed on their homepage a link that says ABA required disclosures or ABA 509 disclosures or ABA consumer information. I don't know why they let us have one of those three, but they do. And from there, should be a one-click link to this 509 report, which is all of the consumer information gathered by the ABA, and it can be a few more clicks to the career information. This is all public now. It's all more or less accurate, more accurate perhaps than it's been in the past. And students should really familiarize themselves. I mean, we at the schools know our competitors and know what their employment is and the percentage of scholarships that are renewed or not renewed, and use that. Our scholarships are guaranteed. We say, take a look at those stipulations. Yeah, maybe you will get your first B ever in your life and lose the scholarship. But look at the employment. Are people getting jobs where I want to practice. A lot of people want to practice in New York, and it's not a commercial, it's just true. And they'll say, oh, but I'm taking the money at this school because they're better, faster, stronger, and more money. And we say, but look at how many people went to New York. And in one example, I was shocked, 3 from a graduating class of 180 had come to New York. And maybe it's all self-selection, but that would be a terrible investment for somebody who wants to start practicing in New York to take that free tuition at a school that doesn't send anybody to New York.
Right. Right. Yeah, I guess it's really defining your goals as you're, weighing your options in terms of which school to attend or how much money to borrow, really laying out your goals. I mean, there's a question on the from one of the attendees about pursuing a career in public interest law. And if that's the case, I mean, obviously, it's not necessarily going to the school with the best public interest program, but also making really smart decisions while you're in law school so you can afford to do public interest work. And do you guys have LRAP programs? And maybe we should touch on that as well if you guys do.
Yes, we have an LRAP program. Our, again, like many things, LRAP programs vary significantly from school to school. Mm-hmm. At Michigan, our LRAP program dovetails with the federal government income-driven repayment plans. We didn't talk a lot about repayment. I know Stephen touched on it, that, there's 10-year plans and 25-year plans, but also plans where your monthly payment is tied to your income. So we support graduates and assist them in making their loan payments if they qualify for and are enrolled in one of those income-driven repayment plans. So the basic gist being you make a lower income, you have a lower monthly payment, and then our school will pay all or some portion of that payment for you for up to 10 years.
So it's not necessarily tied to you actually doing public interest work. Is that right?
Our only requirement is that your job requires a law degree. Uh-huh. It's not limited just to public interest. So we have graduates who are working at small firms. The overwhelming majority of participants are doing public interest, but that's not a requirement. Other schools will have a more specific public interest requirement.
Right. Now, at Fordham, we're one of those schools that has a more specific public interest requirement. So important to look at the details of what the schools are offering in terms of LRAP. Important to be looking out, at least at the federal program. So today there exists a federal public service loan forgiveness program. It's cool. It's great. It's 120 months. Working in government or nonprofit, your loans are forgiven. It's not taxable. We don't know what's happening on that in the future. Right now, for 3 years, President Obama has tried to kill that program for graduate and professional students, wants to use the money for other purposes. Congress has been looking to kill that program because very little gets done in a bipartisan way. They haven't gotten together. But both are looking to dramatically scale back that program for graduate or professional students. So federal public service loan forgiveness program, you may, if you're interested in a career, search that, see what's out there, get involved politically perhaps, writing to your representatives and senators saying, this is important to me, and here's where I won't be able to save the world without taking advantage of this program.
I also would encourage students to, at Maryland, we, similarly to Fordham, we have our own public interest loan repayment assistance program, and it is for public interest jobs. We have actually a very specific list, but I also wanted to encourage students to look at the state. At Maryland, for example, the state of Maryland has its own assistance repayment program in addition to the one from the law school, and the DC Bar Foundation also has one for folks that are serving low-income D.C. residents. So a lot of the students who are living on whether D.C. or Maryland are also able to get that one. The D.C. Bar Foundation one actually has requires that you're certified as an LRAP-eligible employer. So there is a whole list of employers that actually gives you information about who qualifies for the D.C. Bar Foundation one. So there are other, you know, aside from federal and school specific, depending on the state that you want to practice, there are other options as well.
Gotcha. All right, so let me ask you this one last question. And I'm going to ask each of you in turn. If your son or daughter is going to begin law school in the fall, in order to, for them to maximize their ROI, you know, what do you recommend that they look at? You know, and we mentioned job stats. I would imagine that, you know, bar passage rates in the various schools differ. So it's nice to get a license after you graduate. So that's something important to look at. But like your kids starting out law school in the fall, what would you advise them on, you know, approaching the next 3 years? We'll start off with Stephen, since it sounds like
I've been starting things off.
Yeah, no, it's because you've got kids who are going to be paying their own way through law school. So,
indeed. So, make sure law school is right. Make sure you need to go to law school, whether it's the type of job you're looking for, whether it's the type of work you're looking to do. You know, are there other options? Is this something you need? It's perhaps a very Catholic thing. You will be haunted if you need to be a lawyer. It may take 10 or 20 or 30 years, but eventually you'll go to law school if you need to be. I talked with parents a few weeks ago. Oh, if my daughter doesn't go straight into law school, she'll never go. I said, cool. I just saved you $150,000 plus living expenses.
Right.
So know that you want to go to law school. Then look at your options. You know, study, as we talked about. You know, study the outcomes. Which school is going to get me or give me the best chance of getting what I want? And that's very important. And then go to that school, visit, make sure you fit, make sure you're comfortable, that sort of thing. Then go and live like a student while you're in school, although the largest costs tend to be tuition. And give it everything you've got, work hard, and hopefully in 3.5 years you'll be admitted to practice.
I'll boil your comments down to law school is a very expensive way to find yourself if that's not where you're
supposed to be. Don't do that.
Absolutely. And also get ready for some cup of noodles, if you're going to live like a law student. How about you, Lindsay?
So Stephen gave some excellent advice. You have to be sure that this is the right place for you. I think for better or for worse, the barriers to law school are pretty low. You go to undergrad, you take the LSAT, you fill out the application and submit your $75, and boom, there you go. There aren't a lot of educational prerequisites or work experience prerequisites, and so it's an easy place for people to end up if they're just not sure what else to do, and that's a terrible way to spend your time and your money. So knowing that law school is the right thing for you, even if that means taking some time off, finding an internship, finding a job, talking with lawyers, that's all really important. And then, exactly what Stephen said, we don't think of ROI as just a pure financial return. It's what are your goals? Why are you going to law school? And then does anyone from this school do that? Do a lot of people from this school do that? Is it a realistic career path, whatever that path might be for you, from the school or schools that you're considering? And then do the finances, in addition to that, make sense? Some people can forge their own path, but in most cases, you're very likely to be the only person that has ever done X job from a school if no one's ever done it before. So make sure that the resources and the curriculum and the support available can get you where you want to go, and that financially it will make sense for you, even if that means taking on a lot of debt. Okay, can you pay it back with your high-paying job? Or taking on some debt, okay, will a school's LRAP really be a true support for you? Looking at what the federal programs are, but also understanding that federal programs can go away because the government takes, the government gives, the winds change. So really being sure that even with that uncertainty, that you're confident in this decision. And then if you are, I went to law school and I was a practicing attorney, and it can be a great profession. It can be a wonderful educational experience, but it is a huge investment not only financially, but in your time and in your mental energy. And so you want to be sure that you are prepared to make such an investment.
Great advice. Really good advice. Kat, you want to close us out?
Sure. I think they both had great advice. I think it's important to highlight that cost is just one of the factors. And I know this webinar is focused on financial aid, but the school that gives you the most money, just as the school that is the highest ranked, is not necessarily the best option for you. So I think it's the factors, considering cost, location, employment opportunity, the alumni network of the school, and what kind of alumni network they have on the city that you want to practice. Take all of those factors into account and actually create a list of the most important to you in terms of the schools, and see how other schools, how do all
muted
in the different schools to really find the right match for you. Law school is expensive, but a very rewarding experience, especially if you're at a school where you have the right programs, the right services, and you really feel that you're going to be a successful student there.
Unmuted.
Resources and opportunities for you. So I certainly encourage you to talk to us about going through these factors and how to balance them. And if you don't have the answers, you can always email us, set up time to call us. Calls with us. I think students they're not shy about asking for more money, but they are shy about asking important questions about alumni network or information intro resources to help you get the answers that you need so you can make a very informed and smart decision.
Excellent. I think it's a great way to close it out. And now that the Hillary and Bernie Sanders debate is on, I'm sure everybody's going to go watch and hopefully vote for Bernie Sanders now, because they can get a free education. Guys, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. We covered a lot of ground today, and I really appreciate it. And it was worthwhile for me, and I'm sure it was worthwhile for all of our listeners. So thank you. I really appreciate your time.